So the hero of the story that I'm going to tell is this student at the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore in India, Karan Grover. All of this work was done when I was on leave from MIT in India till about 2 months back. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to this wonderful conference. I've learned a great deal about cold atoms. When I first got invited, just like Anders, I didn't know what the heck I was going to talk about because I hadn't particularly been working on cold atoms. But then I realized that this very recent work that we've done actually fits in beautifully with the theme of this conference, the strong correlation physics in a cold atoms context. So I'm very happy actually to be talking about this this meeting. So let me very, very quickly remind you of some general ideas on the quantum magnetism of Mohr insulators. Usually in solid-state physics, we're thinking about electronic Mohr insulators, where because of electron interactions, the charges localize below some energy scale, conventionally denoted U, and below that energy scale, the active low energy degree of freedom, once the charges localize, or the spins of the electron, and the basic problem of quantum magnetism is to determine the fate of these local moments at low temperature. So this fate is determined by an effective Hamiltonian, which often takes this form, where there's an interaction, a spin exchange interaction between neighboring atoms, which typically is antiferromagnetic and has a strength that's given by this some number like T squared over U, where U is this the energy gap to create charged excitations, and T is the strength of the electron hopping from one site to a neighboring site. In principle, as you get closer to the Mohr transition, as the charges get, as this charge energy becomes lower, you could have longer range interactions, ring exchange, all kinds of complicated things, but that's basically the essential story. So in this talk, I'm actually going to be talking about Mohr insulators of bosons, focusing on spin one. As we'll see, that has very interesting physics from the point of view of quantum magnetism, and it's particularly appropriate to think about in the context of this meeting. So let me focus on the particular case where there are an odd number of bosons per lattice site, 1, 3, 5, whatever, and this kind of situation was considered in these papers which came out a few years back. Many of the authors of the second paper are in this room. So low energy physics of such a Mohr insulator is a spin one quantum magnet. So just like for the electronic Mohr insulator, if we ask about an effective Hamiltonian that describes the fate of the spin one moments, one can work that out quite easily. And earlier, what we had was a simple antiferromagnetic nearest neighbor Hamiltonian, but what these people argued was that in that same level of approximation to leading order in T over U, you get a much more interesting Hamiltonian, one which has both this bilinear interaction, typically with a ferromagnetic sign, but not necessarily so. But in addition, also this biquadratic interaction, which has which is a product of four-spin operators. So this biquadratic term is very natural for bosons, and it already appears in the leading order of this T over U expansion. Okay. So I, pulled out this graph of a plot of the strength of the bilinear to biquadratic interaction from this paper by Imambekov, Dimler, and Lukin from a few years back. So this calculation was done for the specific case of sodium 23 atoms in an optical lattice, assuming reasonable values for various parameters. And the interesting thing, what's plotted here is this ratio as a function of the number of bosons per site. So I said we're already specializing, I'm focusing on the case where we have an odd number of bosons per site. So this point here corresponds to one boson per site, and you see that the biquadratic interaction is about as big as the bilinear interaction. So this ratio is more or less one, close to one, if you have exactly one boson per site. And already, when you get to three bosons per site, the bilinear interaction is enormously suppressed, and what you have is more or less just a pure biquadratic Hamiltonian. Okay? And you know, you can go to higher boson numbers and you get, well, the results more or less don't change. So already, whether you're working at one boson per site or three bosons per site, you have access to a very, very interesting regime of quantum magnetism that in electronic systems is not very natural. So that tells you why bosons are interesting for quantum magnetism. This large boy quadratic term gives you access, perhaps easily, to phenomena that you may not see so commonly in electronic quantum magnets. And more speculatively, one might imagine that in the presence of such interactions that are unusual in the electronic context, you have a possible route to some of the exotic phenomena that we know quantum magnets can in principle exhibit, but haven't quite seen in any models that are natural for particular physical systems. And in particular, you know, if Matthew had been around this morning and giving this talk, he would have talked about quantum spin liquids, you know, which again, we know that quantum magnets can go into such spin liquid phases. There's a lot of interest in the condensed matter community in doing experiments on such spin liquid phases and finding them in experiments and studying them. But I guess it's fair to say there's been no unambiguous realization of such spin liquids in electronic quantum magnets. And likewise, these deconfined quantum critical points, or this Landau-Forbidden quantum phase transitions that we heard about in the last two talks, once again, there's a lot of interest in solid state physics and understanding this kind of phase transition better in the context of models that are natural for physical systems. And one might tentatively hope that perhaps with these spin one magnets with this large boy quadratic term, that's enough to get you into situations where you end up with these kinds of exotic phenomena. As you'll see, exactly that kind of thing seems very, very possible in very simple situations with spin one boson Mott insulators. So the problem, at least the low temperature problem posed by this boson Mott insulator, is to try and understand the properties of this Hamiltonian, which has a both a bilinear and biquadratic interaction in various dimensions. So some properties of this kind of model are quite well known in the quantum magnetism literature. So this bilinear term dominates, and given that it has a ferromagnetic sign, it's very natural to expect that the ordering in the ground state is ferromagnetic. Right? So that's simple, and from the point of view of quantum magnetism, it's mostly boring. So the more interesting physics happens when this ratio of the bilinear and biquadratic interactions is some number that's of order 1 or smaller. Right? And as we've seen from this calculation from Imambeko and company, this regime is actually quite natural, at least for some bosonic Mott insulator, sodium 23, for instance. So this is the regime which is interesting from the point of view of quantum magnetism, but it's great that that's also the natural regime for this boson Mott insulator. So one thing that's immediately clear in the presence of this, in this regime, is that within some kind of simple-minded mean field theory, this biquadratic term actually favors a certain kind of spin ordering that's been mentioned in a few talks before at this meeting, known as spin nematic ordering. So this was pointed out, I guess, more than three decades ago. So spin nematic order corresponds to the development of a non-zero expectation value for the second rank tensor that you form from these local moments without any average magnetic moment itself. And this expectation about the role of this biquadratic term has comparatively recently been confirmed through very, very detailed Monte Carlo calculations by these people on square and cubic lattices. So I guess at some point in two or three dimensions on a square or cubic lattice, we know what this model does in the physically relevant regime for the sodium 23 atoms. So from a less formal point of view, what the spin nematic state is, it's the following. It's a state in which you have a spontaneous single ion anisotropy without any magnetic ordering. So this state breaks spin rotation symmetry, but because There is no magnetic moment. It does not break time reversal symmetry. So physically, what it means is that the spins are fluctuating, but they're fluctuating in a plane that's perpendicular to a common axis, which is the so-called hard axis. And the direction of this hard axis is spontaneously determined. This direction is picked out by spontaneous symmetry breaking. So that's what the spin nematic state is. So I said that this kind of spin nematic ordering is seen in two or three dimensions. Now clearly, if you go to one spatial dimension, you should expect that this physics will change, because the spin nematic state completely breaks spin rotation symmetry, and quantum fluctuations you should expect would be too strong in one dimension to permit that kind of ordering. And that's indeed the case. The spin nematic ordering is indeed unstable to quantum fluctuations. So then the question is, what happens in the ground state? Now, there's a very old proposal going back about 15 years that says that one natural state that can result is simply a featureless gapped paramagnetic ground state with short-range correlations for all order parameters. Very analogous to people who are familiar with quantum magnets know as the Haldane phase of spin one chains with predominantly antiferromagnetic short-range interactions. This proposal has been examined numerically several times in the last 15 years, and the most extensive and careful numerics probably been done by this group very, very recently. One of the authors of this paper, Simon Trebst, is probably right in this room at this moment. And so far, there's basically been no evidence for this kind of state in numerics on single chain, on just a single spin one chain with this bilinear biquadratic Hamiltonian. No, the K-term actually prefers, if you just diagonalize on a two-side problem, you'll see that K-term prefers, doesn't prefer ferromagnetic, it prefers singlets. So what instead happens in one dimension is that the true ground state is a dimerized valence bond solid paramagnet in which neighboring pairs of spin ones form singlets with each other, and the system spontaneously chooses whether to form singlets on the even bonds or whether to form singlets on the odd bonds. So the system spontaneously breaks lattice symmetry and goes into a paramagnetic phase with the spin gap, and there's no trace of any, there's certainly no trace of long-range spin nematic order. So this, is the basic story for this model in the regime of interest in one, two, and three dimensions. But an interesting question arises immediately. Given that we know that in two dimensions, for instance, on a square lattice, the ordering is into the spin nematic state, and one dimension, the spin nematic is destroyed, is there some way to kill the spin nematic ordering already in two dimensions by somehow increasing the strength of quantum fluctuations? What kinds of ground states might one be able to access in that context? So one way to do this was dreamed up by Harada Kawashima and Matthias Troyer, and Matthias is somewhere in this room. So the idea is, again, very, very simple, and certainly in the context of future experiments in cold atoms, certainly, at least in principle, looks like it's realizable, which is to simply weaken the bonds along the vertical direction, right? So if you imagine weakening all the bonds in the vertical direction by a factor lambda, then the system is much more strongly coupled in the horizontal direction than it is in the vertical direction. So as lambda increases, you're increasing the strength of quantum fluctuations. So eventually, you have to lose the broken spin rotation symmetry, lose the nematic order beyond some critical lambda, and presumably go into a state that somehow has to evolve into the dimer state that you get when these bonds have simply disappeared. Okay, so I should say that this entire model that I wrote down is actually, one can simulate it without any sign problem, so it's possible to do very detailed calculations of the phase diagram and all kinds of other properties. So that was what was done in this paper by Matthias Troyer and his collaborators. This contains a lot more information than is pertinent for the boson-Mohr insulator. So the, what's plotted on this axis is the ratio of the bilinear to biquadratic interaction, and what's plotted on the vertical axis is the strength of the vertical bonds relative to the strength of the horizontal bonds. And the regime along the horizontal axis that's relevant for the sodium 23 Mohr insulator is somewhere in this range. Basically, you know, from J over K being roughly 1 to J over K being perhaps slightly negative. But and you see this is the range in which if lambda is 1, so that you're in a true square lattice in two dimensions, you get pneumatic ordering, and as you decrease this lambda, thereby increasing quantum fluctuations, eventually the pneumatic ordering gives way to some other phase, and this phase is simply the, you know, the same dimer-ordered phase that I already talked about in one dimension. So, so at this stage, the interesting thing is that first you're able to kill the pneumatic ordering by making the system look more one-dimensional, and second, there's no other intervening phase. You go directly from this pneumatic ordered state to this dimer ordered state simply by weakening the coupling between chains. Even more dramatic is that when these people zoomed in right on this phase transition and looked at it, there was a surprise, and it turns out that to the extent that one can tell from this kind of fairly extensive numerics, this pneumatic dimer transition seems to be second order. So the reason that's a surprise is that just like in the previous two talks, from Landau theory, you would have said that this was impossible because the pneumatic breaks spin rotation symmetry, while this dimer ordered phase breaks a completely different symmetry. It breaks translational symmetry, and so there's no particular reason to expect that that second-order transition could result between these two phases, but that's indeed what's found in the numerics. And they've also been able to extract some estimates for some critical exponents. So I should say that these calculations, the biggest sizes that they calculated in were quite big. It was 192 by 48 sites. So it's a huge system. And the correlation length, you know, the question is if the transition is second order, is it really second order or not? And the correlation length apparently is at least bigger than about 100 lattice spacings, if not more. So the, you know, I mean, as far as numerics goes, this is good evidence. Of course, as Anders said, you could always ask about what happens if you, you know, increase the system size by a factor of 10, but okay. But this is at least very, very suggestive that this, that the way in which the pneumatic order disappears as you weaken the interchain coupling is that it, this, what's almost a second-order transition, perhaps a true second-order transition, to the dimer-ordered state. And that's interesting because it, if that were to happen, then the resulting phase transition has to be something exotic. It's you know, falls in the same genre of phenomena as the kinds of things Ashwin and Anders Sandvik were talking about in the previous two talks. So the questions that, you know, I would like to try and give some indication of the answers for in this talk, there are two qualitative questions first. You know, why is it that numerics has never seen this featureless disordered spin pneumatic in the 1D spin chain? Right. So that's the first question. And a related question is the mechanism for the appearance of dimer order when the pneumatic ordering is destroyed. You know, the dimer doesn't seem to have anything to do with this pneumatic order parameter. Right? So is there a natural way to think about the appearance of dimer order when you kill the pneumatic order? I mean, what's the connection between these two very, very distinct kinds of order parameters that makes it natural for one to rear its head when you suppress the other? Right? And so once one understands this, and I'll try to give you some understanding of the answer to this question, it turns out to be possible to develop a theory for a possible Landau-Fobiden spin pneumatic to dimer transition, which is a fairly straightforward generalization of the theory that Ashwin presented in his talk, but for the nail to VBS transition. I don't know how much of this I'll actually be able to convey, but at least I'll indicate, I'll sketch the theory of this transition. So in thinking about these questions, and in general, in thinking about these quantum phases and their phase transitions, it's very, very important to understand the structure of the topological defects of this ordered phase, in this case the spin pneumatic. And the spin pneumatic, as with any other pneumatic, is characterized by this spontaneous hard axis D. So this defines the direction that's perpendicular to the direction to the plane in which the spins are fluctuating. And this hard axis lives on the surface of a two-sphere where two antipodal points are identified with each other. That's because of the spontaneous hard axis, D and minus D are the exact same state. So it lives actually on S2 mod Z2. So it has the immediate implication that this state has a defect which is a point vortex which has just a Z2 existence, which in this pneumatic context is usually known as a disclination. And what it looks like is this. So if you go around the core of such a disclination, this hard axis D, it winds around and comes back to minus of itself. Right? There's still a smooth configuration at long distances because D and minus D are really the same state. So there's a topologically non-trivial configuration of this hard axis, in this context is known as a disclination. It's a vortex, but it has only a Z2 existence. So these defects are known to play an extremely crucial role in phase transitions where the pneumatic ordering is destroyed. And this sort of thing was discussed at great length in the theory of classical pneumatic liquid crystals 15 years ago, maybe slightly less. At least theoretically, the theory of the classical pneumatic allows for several distinct phases. Low temperature, let's say, has some sort of pneumatic liquid crystal. Then as you heat the system, there's a conventional isotropic liquid that you could go into. But it turns out that if you fool around with the disclination core energy, if you make the disclination core energy very, very large, it's also possible to go into some exotic isotropic liquid which still remembers something about the topological defect structure of this pneumatic phase. So that's what one may call a topological isotropic state. So what's the difference between these two kinds of isotropic states which are descend from this pneumatic state? So in the first case, the ordinary isotropic liquid, what happens is that at this finite temperature phase transition, it's driven by the unbinding of disclinations. So once the disclinations unbind, you of course kill the pneumatic order. But it turns out, as explained by these people, that it's possible to kill the pneumatic ordering without actually unbinding the disclinations. It's actually somewhat similar to what Ashwin was doing earlier in his talk, where he was killing the ordering in a Heisenberg model without proliferating the defects, the hedgehogs. This is somewhat simpler, and it turns out you can kill the pneumatic without proliferating these Z2 disclinations, and you get this exotic phase, which is the finite temperature analog of some of the phases that Alexei Kitaev was talking about, 2 days ago. So armed with this insight, let's think about the quantum spin pneumatic, and one immediately realizes that quantum mechanics is different. So instead of increasing the temperature, I imagine increasing quantum fluctuations, for instance, by weakening the interchain coupling. And once again, there are two kinds of ways in which you can kill the spin pneumatic ordering in two space dimensions. One of them is to proliferate the disclinations. The other is to disorder the pneumatic without unbinding the disclinations. Now, if you kill the pneumatic without unbinding the disclinations, you again go into some exotic topological paramagnet, yeah? You're not disordering the topological phase, you're disordering a broken symmetry phase. You're accessing a topological state, and the reason you're able to access this is that the disclinations here, which have both a core energy and a long distance winding energy, the core energy of this distillation stays finite at this transition, and they survive into this phase but without the long distance winding. So there is a gap. So the topological defect, the distillation of the state, survives as a gapped, Z2 vortex-like excitation in this phase. So this is actually a Z2 topological phase. It's fractionalized and so on and so forth. They are unbound. That's right. Absolutely. No. It's a question of language, right? So these guys are suppressed at the transition, meaning they're not. Their core energy is not going to zero at this transition, right? So the core energy is not going to zero. They survive as gapped excitation in this phase. So you look at low energies, these defects are not there. But you can create them if you provide a finite energy gap, right? But the main difference in the phase diagram, the place where quantum mechanics makes a difference actually, is in the conventional isotropic phase, right? So if you do the standard thing that you do to kill the pneumatic ordering in a classical pneumatic, here you get something different. And what I'll try to argue, is that what you instead get, the conventional isotropic is replaced by this dimerized isotropic magnetic state, the dimerized paramagnet. So the reason you get dimerization here is that, as I'll show, the distillations carry non-trivial quantum Berry phases, which are clearly specific to quantum mechanics. Right? So due to the non-trivial quantum mechanics of the problem, there are phase factors associated with the motion of these distillations, which then leads to broken translational symmetry and to dimer order if you kill the pneumatic ordering, not in this exotic way, but in this conventional way. Okay. So basically, quantum mechanics have win-win situations. You can either try to do it in this exotic way, then you go into an exotic state, or you can try to do it in a conventional way, in which you also get into something interesting and exotic. Right? I mean, it's interesting in the sense that it's a completely different broken symmetry. So let me give you a qualitative explanation of where this Berry phase comes from. So let's consider a single spin one moment in a time-varying hard axis. Right? The Hamiltonian for such a moment is described simply by this thing. At any given point of time, if you just diagonalize this Hamiltonian, the spin likes to point perpendicular to the hard axis. So now imagine adiabatically evolving the direction of this hard axis from where it was initially pointing to minus of itself. Right? So that's a closed path in Hamiltonian space, and associated with that, there could be, in general, some Berry space. And for a spin one moment, this is a straightforward calculation, and you can see the ground state wave function acquires a Berry phase of pi. Right? So the minus one that's associated with time evolution where the spontaneous hard axis flips. Okay. So one way to think about this path where the spontaneous hard axis flips is that you simply take a distillation that's centered, coming back to the lattice, a distillation centered at some plaquette, and then drag this distillation around such a loop, and the effect of that is to flip the spontaneous hard axis on the central side from up from wherever it was pointing to minus of itself. So that's the same process as dragging this distillation around a loop that encloses that point. So we therefore conclude that if you drag a distillation around such a loop, then, at that side, at the side enclosed by the loop, the hard axis changes sign, and this process is done slowly, then you have an adiabatic evolution of the hard axis at this side. And then the wave function of the system, therefore, acquires a Berry phase of pi, which means that the motion of these defects, which naturally occurs in the dual lattice, because the defects are centered on plaquettes, this motion naturally occurs in the dual lattice, but as they move, coming from the background quantum spins, they see a flux of pi through each plaquette. Right? So it's as though these defects are in a magnetic field, and they see this background flux that's coming from the quantized spin that's present at each site. Now, as we know from solving problems of the quantum mechanics of particles in a magnetic field, translations are realized very, very non-trivially in the presence of a magnetic field, so the implication is that these defects transform non-trivially under lattice translations because this average background magnetic field with a flux of pi through each plaquette. So this then has two consequences. First, the defects condense, which is the conventional way to kill the pneumatic order. Then, of course, the pneumatic order is going to be destroyed. But given this, these defects transform non-trivially under lattice translations, it means the lattice translation symmetry is broken, and it's quite natural to expect that some kind of dimer order will result. So this is the physics behind why the relationship between the dimer order and the pneumatic order. It comes from the fact that the defects of the pneumatic order, because of quantum effects, carry non-trivial phase factors, which affects your motion in such a way that when they condense, the system can't help but break translational symmetry. And you can, you know, go through the same argument in one dimension, and that gives an explanation of why there's no featureless disordered spin pneumatic phase in 1D. So this may be a bit intense, but let me quickly sketch the how one can use this understanding to develop a theory for this pneumatic to dimer transition. So it'll be very, very schematic, but you know, it's basically based on 2 decades of experience with analyzing such problems in quantum antiferromagnetism. So we basically understood the degrees of freedom that are responsible for this phase transition. We of course have to worry about the dynamics of the hard axis itself, but clearly we also have to worry about the dynamics of the defects, which are these Z2 disclinations. And these disclinations, the quantum mechanics of the spin 1 magnet is contained in the statement that there's a background pi flux per plaquette due to these Berry phase effects that I talked about in the previous 2 slides. And finally, we have to make sure that these defects are indeed defects of this hard axis D. So we have to impose this infinitely long-range statistical interaction that tells you that when the D goes around the defect, the entire system acquires a phase of pi. Okay? So that sort of thing is not actually convenient to work with due to this infinitely long-range statistical interaction. But fortunately, we have a lot of experience working with this kind of theory, and there are various techniques that one can exploit to reformulate this kind of problem as a somewhat more familiar, more conventional kind of field theory that, you know, static people can actually work with. And interestingly, it turns out to be a theory written in terms of a 3-component complex unit vector. You know, the little d that I was working with earlier is just the physical thing. It's a spontaneous hard axis. It's a 3-component real unit vector. But the critical theory, it turns out, is naturally formulated as a 3-component complex unit vector, and it's coupled minimally to a fluctuating U1 gauge field, which I've denoted a mu. So this model is actually a direct generalization of the model that Ashwin and Anders Sandvik talked about earlier today. It has 3 complex components instead of 2 complex components, which is the model they were working with, and it goes under the name of an anisotropic NCCP2 model. And one other difference with the models that they ended up with is that just like in Ashwin's talk, there were these hedgehogs which were quadrupled and so on and so forth. Here there are double space-time monopoles of this U1 gauge field. The reason it's double instead of quadrupled is that it's basically ultimately related to the fact that the dimer order parameter in this context, where the lattice is rectangular, the dimer ground state is 2-fold degenerate as opposed to a square lattice where it's 4-fold degenerate. So that's the origin of this difference. Right, so this part is the non-compacting, and then this guy, you know, the transition can be second order only if this guy is irrelevant, and there are indications that it is. Oh, the self, that's just bosonic. At least in a semi-classical type description, it's bosonic. There's a more exotic possibility where it could be something else, but, you know.
But is that something that's an input to the theory? Is that something you can show?
In a semi-classical type description of the pneumatic order and its fluctuations, it is naturally bosonic. Now, the more extreme quantum situations in which one can, you know, conceive that it could change its statistics, but you know, that's so much more exotic than anything anyone's done. That, yeah, even I won't go there. Maybe Matthew would be. Anyway, so the important questions about this field theory: how do we identify the natural order parameters that, you know, we can measure? So the pneumatic order parameters, again, simply given as a second-ranked symmetric tensor in terms of these fields, and you see the pneumatic order parameters bilinear in terms of this the natural fields of the theory. So in that sense, this theory is also written in terms of fractionalized variables which are interacting with some gauge field. So dynamo order parameter, just like in various other instances of this kind of phase transition, is somewhat more complicated in this formulation, and it corresponds to a process in which you change the flux of this gauge field by 2 pi at some point in space. So it's an expectation value of a single monopole operator. The phase transition, this formulation, simply described as a condensation of D. So if D condenses, then clearly the pneumatic, there is pneumatic ordering. And if D is gapped, then the pneumatic ordering is killed, and there are various arguments, and basically the system has no option but to end up condensing this operator and lead to dimer order. I didn't tell you how D was defined. It's just I just told you that you can reformulate it as a, in terms of three component complex unit vector. Yeah, there is a simple interpretation in terms of pictures, but that requires explaining everything in a completely different way. So I can talk to you later if you want. Right. So there's a somewhat of a simple picture that you can give in terms of the. In terms of the configurations of the dimer order parameter and the vortices in that. So the crucial issue, as before, is to know whether this extra stuff with these double monopoles are irrelevant. And this is the kind of thing that's very, very hard to calculate analytically. In fact, it's never been calculated for this kind of problem in anything other than the log-n expansion, which in any case converges quite not so well. But one can make a crude estimate that's based on an extrapolation of what of the measurements that Anders Sandvik did for the related problem, which has one fewer component for this fluctuating d field. So if you have two fluctuating components, Anders has an estimate of some monopole of the scaling of, you know, of the scaling dimension of this kind of operator. And if you combine that with some reasonable guesses for how the scaling dimension scales with the number of components and the charge of the monopole, you get a number that quite strongly suggests that this thing may actually be irrelevant. So the reason why this twofold anisotropy is already enough to make this thing be irrelevant, it's simply that you increase the number of components as compared to the theory that you get for the nail to VBS transition. So with increasing number of components, one expects that lower strength monopoles will be more irrelevant. And that's indeed, so it's conceivable that it's irrelevant. At least the crude estimate suggests that it's irrelevant. So if this is the case, you know, if some future more careful calculation confirms this suggestion, then what we indeed have is a direct second-order phase transition between this pneumatic-ordered state and this dimer and this dimer-ordered state, with a flow diagram that looks basically exactly the same as what Ashwin showed earlier today. This double monopoles become irrelevant at this critical point, and on one side you flow to this pneumatic-ordered state, but on the other side you flow into what looks like a state with no dimer order, just the featureless, disordered spin pneumatic, except that it's eventually unstable towards developing this dimer order. It is some sort of analog of the I star phase. It's more like a U1 I star. It's not stable to. That's right. Yeah. Sorry. So as I said, so the best that one can do about such, you know, monopole operators, which, you know, we have no real control on, is to make some crude estimate of the scaling dimension. Right? So the crude estimate that it's currently possible to make, right, suggests that may be relevant, but clearly, you know, and this combined with the fact that numerically Matthias Troyer and company find a second order transition is use circumstantial evidence that this may actually be irrelevant. But to do better than this requires some serious numerical calculation, which has never been ever been done for this kind of phase transition before. No, I'm talking about this critical point. Oh, out here it's certainly, this flow is very well controlled. Right. Yeah, that's right, yeah. Okay, so let me quickly conclude. So in terms of consequences for numerics, you know, given that it's so hard to calculate these monopole scaling dimensions, can we just, if we assume that these crude estimates are correct, and assume the monopoles are irrelevant, can we predict something that can be checked numerically? So it turns out there's actually a very spectacular consequence, which is exactly analogous to what Anders talked about in his talk. The dynamo order parameter asymptotically close to the transition basically becomes XY-like if the monopoles are irrelevant, for exactly the same reason as before. So this means that there'll be power law correlations with the same exponent, not just for the natural horizontal dynamo order, but also for vertical dynamo order, which in this problem occurred at a completely different momentum. Right? So that's a non-trivial test of this kind of thing, which future numerics on the spin 1 model presumably can directly, you know, look for. The most important issues at this stage from the point of view of theory is a direct simulation of this field theory action, field theory Hamiltonian, which can be done with, you know, classical Monte Carlo to actually test for this irrelevance of double monopoles, though I'm told that this sort of thing is extremely difficult. But even, you know, forgetting about this, the monopoles, just to take this theory and to calculate critical exponents and so on, which can then be compared with the numerics on the more quantum, on the more microscopic model that Matthias and company have simulated. Well, I don't have much of a summary except to say that bosonic Morton sliders with spin, interestingly, turn out to be rather natural model quantum magnets for studying some of the exotic phenomena that many of us in the field of quantum magnetism have been thinking about for the last many years. That's it.
Square lattice, you need the closure power monopole to be irrelevant.
That's correct.
Here, only need the double. What's the main difference here?
Oh, it's related to the fact that dynamo order parameter is only, dynamo ground state is only 2-fold degenerate.
So you 4 divided by 2, you get 2.
or just 2 times 1. It's just 2-fold degenerate. I mean, that's, you know, this, which strength monopole you need is related to how degenerate the dynamo ground state is. So square lattice, it's 4-fold degenerate.
Yeah, in square lattice, closure power is shown to be irrelevant easily.
It's argued to be irrelevant through a variety of arguments which all point in the same direction. So there's some general consistent picture. So and Anders' numerics are supporting it because he's directly measuring the extent to which these quadrupole monopoles are irrelevant with these pictures.
Yeah, so why is it so difficult to show here is irrelevant? You said it's very difficult.
Oh, so, you know, so what I've estimated so far, you know, one can give an estimate exactly in the same way as one can estimate for quadrupole monopoles in the CP1 theory. But if you want to do something beyond some crude estimate, it's very hard. It's equally hard in, you know, for the nail to VBS transition on square lattice. You have to do the kind of work that Anders has done if you're working in the spin model.
Hey, Santiago, I just want to make two comments. One is that my student Snoke actually did a very similar calculations for the exchange interaction for sodium atoms for one particle mode state and a large N limit for his master thesis. Those results were actually presented in PRB same year as you.
Okay, thank you. I was in, I'll add that paper to the list of
The other comment is later on, actually, same year, we also look at the relation between the valence bond crystal in 1D and the ground state of the sun demoisson and dimer state.
The ground state of, sorry, what?
The art class of the dimer state, Sondi and Moissner studied.
Oh, Sondi, Moissner.
So effectively, okay. It's sort of your Z2
gauge field.
We sort of derived the connection between the dimerized valence bond crystal and the ground state of the Z2 using the nonlinear sigma model approach.
Okay, very good. Thanks.
Senthil, I have a sort of more elementary question. Coming back to your picture, you had two very unrelated phases, and they landed up at one point.
Right.
So, so what you said was you are generating these topological defects, which is, you know, sort of destroying the what would have been the disordered phase and pushing it to a point, but then the same defects must be acting on. Must be getting generated from both the phases to produce that point. I haven't quite understood how, from both sides you can still land up at the same point.
No, so the argument works in the following way. You take the defect of the pneumatic, let's say, and then you decrease its core energy to zero, and then and as you further decrease it, it'll just condense.
Okay.
Right? When it condenses, you clearly kill the pneumatic ordering,
right?
Because the defects are moving all over the
right place.
But if this condensate breaks some other symmetry, condensate breaks translational symmetry because of quantum interference, Berry phase and so on. That leads to dimer order on the other side.
I see. Okay.
Hey, Sandro, I just have a comment for this model in the Lagrangian language corresponds to the n equals 2. Actually, the same physics for n equals 3, for example, for spin 3/2 magnetic system, the one-dimensional limit is dimerized and two-dimensional limit is nailed, and you have a rectangular lattice. The same physics will occur, and it has even better because in the n CP3 is the N4 is larger.
Sorry, I'm not able to hear you properly.
I mean, this model is very nice, but I want to point out every time you have spin 3/2 fermions, whereas in the larger end, the N is even larger, and they have the same physics. One dimensional is dimerized, and the two dimensional limit is nailed. And in between, if you have especially anisotropic.
That's conceivable that's even
yes.
more.
Yes, so but in that case, this double monopole events, the scaling dimension probably be nicer.
That's
here.
Right, yeah, sure.
So if here, the numerical has already shown some promising, encouraging signature, I would expect for n equals the CP3 case will be even more reliable, and actually it's also related to a realistic system.
I see.
And
okay.
It also has even more beautiful mathematical structure of hidden symmetry of the SP4.
Okay, so maybe somebody should do a Monte Carlo calculation.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
The 3/2 model. Looks interesting.
Thank you. I think we better move on. Let's thank the speaker for this terrific talk.